Well, if you're just tuning in, you've definitely found the right place. This is Jazz Alternatives program, one of several that are heard on Monday through Friday evenings between 6 p.m. and 9. This is the centerpiece, chronologically, and also one of the focal points of any week of broadcasting at WKCR, an evening devoted to the work of a single artist and having the artist here to say some words about it, and sometimes about other topics. You may know the voice of a gentleman who's about to put his voice on radio from his having visited WKCR many times through the years as a strong friend of the station and describing some of the manifold musical activities that Makonda Ken McIntyre has been a part of for many years, such as 35 years of being a recording artist and nearly as long of being a part of music education in one of the strongest programs locally. He is also a wind instrumentalist who might be best known as an alto saxophone player, but any one of his records would show you also a double reed player, a flute player, and a clarinetist. And all four aspects of Makonda playing those instruments will be on view tonight between now and 9 p.m. in a way that's seldom been documented before. What you've just heard is the sound of four flutes as played by Makonda in all four cases in an overdub recording that has recently been completed and one would hope someday might be more readily available than just tuning in on a radio station that broadcasts from a windowless booth on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But here we are. We'll be doing it in the first time this music has been put on the air. And I'm going to invite the gentleman who conceived and executed the music, Makonda, to, first of all, thank you very much for coming to our studio, as humble as it certainly is in these days, and also for bringing some music that's not been heard before, and for making the trip yourself to explain what it is about this music that you feel is significant and how it came about so that those who are hearing it for the first time as significant music can understand what went into it. Makonda Ken McIntyre.
Good evening. Thanks, Ben. I'd like to say I'm delighted to be here. I feel privileged, very privileged. What you've just heard are two selections on flutes. And we have one more on flute, and then we have clarinets, double reeds, and saxophones. What I did, I went in the studio, and I decided to overdub some things so I could hear what it would sound like. It was a lot of fun, a lot of work. But I had a purpose in mind. I wanted to hear the music phrased in a certain kind of way, but also I wanted to put together something that could appeal to students who may not improvise, may go to conservatories or schools where they don't improvise, because the music could be played, I could play the music or solo on the music while they read the music as a guest, if I were a guest in performance. And then there's an ensemble part. On all the pieces, there's an ensemble part which goes someplace else. I'm not going to categorize it, but it's a different context. The melody and the harmonies and counterpoint, and then there's improvisation. Then after that, there's an ensemble part, and each one goes someplace else. Then it comes back to the melody, and we take it out. So it's very a structured form. All the pieces are very structured. And I'm here to share this with the community to, if possible, get some feedback with respect to how the community views this. And I guess in order to get that feedback, I could say, well, you could call the station while we're here.
Which is true.
854-9290. Yeah. And further, you know, if you wanted to call me at home, I live uptown. My number uptown is 212-781-5674. My machine is in the shop now, so if you call me and no one answers, I'm not there. I'm here for those who may call tonight.
Well, and it's our good fortune that you're here. For those who may not even own a telephone, but they might own a radio, you people are in the right place, too. And you can stay where you are and listen to it and perhaps write a letter or something in the coming days. I know that one of the questions that some people ask, Makonda, is was this music written or was it, should I say, was it orchestrated or arranged with the idea that you would be playing all four parts? Or was it written with the idea that a wind ensemble would execute it someday and that turned around? And would there be a difference if it were going either way?
Oh, ideally, it's written for players. I'm in music because I want to play with people, you know. But I don't have, as they say, deep pockets. So therefore, I couldn't go out and say, look, hey, I'd like to run over these flute pieces and... can I get you to rehearse, you know, and then we go into a studio. That's just it's untenable. But I would ideally like to have groups of people, you know, and there are many musicians, or I know several, who play most of those instruments. And, you know, so it's possible. It's workable, you know. It's just a matter of demand, I guess.
Sure, yeah. Well, there's to dwell on a couple of things for a minute. I know that, multi-track projects in jazz history and in jazz recording are known very well. As in some cases, I guess in the early days, people would think that that's the last branching out that you do when you think you've come to the end of all of the acoustic real-time artistry you can do is maybe to play with yourself or to see what you can create as though you were bouncing off yourself in some cases. And I know it seems like, on the one hand, there might be a danger of knowing too much if you're the sole player, if you're putting it in, for instance, as the arranger, as the player of all the solos, as the player of all the ensemble parts. And maybe the question that follows that is, do you think it's easier in a way because you can correct yourself very easily, or is it harder because you know... exactly how every part should go, unlike if you gave the parts out to people, they would know their part and could play it and in a more concentrated state.
It's more or less the latter. It's very embarrassing. You play something, you say, oh, really? And you say, oh, man. But I have to step back and take a philosophical view, and I view this as art. And in that moment, this is what happened. So what you're experiencing, and I must say this is a process. You're going to hear, we're starting out with the flutes. That's how I recorded it, with the flutes. And then the next, I went down. So when you get to the end, I will have become familiar with the idea of sitting down, listening to a metronome, our click track, I guess, and having ear, cans on my head, mm-hmm. And going crazy in the process, and I kind of got over to a certain point, I guess maybe halfway through this or three quarters of the way, where I became comfortable. I must share with you, though, all the solos that I took, I was so relieved to get to the solo parts that they were just like this.
To get to them or to get through them?
When I got to them, it's just as I got to them, I just played one, just down. Frank, the engineer, would say, "Hey, I would say, what's next?" Because we'd have a score, and he'd know where. And I'd say, "Well," and I'd pick up that instrument to play. In other words, I didn't take a second take.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I didn't go over anything because, like I said, I'm thinking artistically, and
it's a document of how it went down the first time.
That's it.
The first time, four times over, I guess. One way of looking.
Yeah,
at it.
Yeah. Well, you lay the tracks.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a minute then to explain what exactly the layers are on the flutes that we've just been hearing. The instrumentation.
Bass flute, alto flute, and two C flutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I call it a flute quartet.
Mm-hmm.
The bass flute was really a tremendous challenge because I had I hadn't purchased it that long, and I haven't really had that much playing, so I had to work rapidly, fast, you know, fast forward everything to get it to work. The alto flute is, I don't play that very often because you don't get a call for it. The C flute, well, that's the one I play all the time. But so it was a lot of fun, lot of fun.
And the two layers of C flute with the alto flute
and tenor and a bass flute, I should say. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you lay it the same way with all the instruments that you'd start with the bottom and work up?
Yeah, I think I did. I found that because the bottom is the bass part is the bass part. And when I lay that foundation, then I can get a little cute on the top. If the bass is laid in, you know, if it's making sense to me, you know, lay the first one down, the second one down, say, this is working. Then in your head, everything works. But when you're playing it and you're hearing this stuff going in these cans, it's fascinating. Very fascinating. Right. Yeah.
I guess if our listeners want to simulate that at home, you can go and plug in your headphones right now, and you'll have everything but the knowledge of what part you're supposed to play while you listen to the next few tracks, if you're going to lay a fifth layer on top of it. And the two pieces we heard at the beginning of the program, the first one is called Amy. The blues called Amy, I should say. The second is Blanche. And I hope I'm going to pronounce the third one right. In fact, maybe I'll get an assist from the composer.
Charshi. The first tune, Amy, is a calypso. It was a calypso. And it was on, much of this has been recorded. Amy was on an album on Steeplechase Home. Blanche was on Prestige New Jazz album called Stone Blues. And Charshi is also on that same album. Charshi is my wife. I wrote this for her, I guess, in 1960. Yeah.
And it was recorded in the same year.
Yeah. No, is that what year I did it? 60?
I believe the Stone Blues is from 60.
No, 61. Looking ahead, I think it was 60. Anyway, but I wrote it before then, if it's 60. I wrote it maybe in 58 or 59, because I don't write music and go in the studio. I have music written for years, and I say if I'm going to the studio, I go and look, and I try and go back to, pieces that I've, as I write them, because I date them when I write them. So I'll go back and say, I think, you know, I've done this. Let's get to this, and that's how I work.
Mm-hmm. And those of you who may have had the good fortune, anywhere along the line, really, to whether it's to Five Spot 1967 or in concerts throughout the 70s and 80s, or maybe even in some of the modern appearances of Makonda's group, you would know not only the recorded versions in their original recordings, but some of the stage presence realizations of those same pieces. And now maybe here's a third version using no rhythm section per se, and instead wind instruments in many layers. Maybe we should cross back into the music then and hear Charshi, which you've just described, and maybe move across the seam into the clarinet world, if that's all right.
Fine.
And then we'll come back and say some words.
Very good.
First, the word is it's 19 minutes before 7 p.m. This is WKCR-FM at 89.9. We'll be with you until 9 o'clock with some sounds from a recent project of Makonda Ken McIntyre. We've just heard two of the pieces from this recent recording, and they are for four flutes and then for four clarinets, respectively. The first one, as described in our last little segment of discourse, was called Charshi, and again, it comes from a record made in 1960, I believe, called The Stone Blues, which is, shockingly enough, it's available again in the world of music. And then a piece that is called Peas and Rice for four clarinets. And Makonda, maybe we should spring into the clarinet dimension of it and ask you to run down what the four parts in the clarinet are. And maybe also at the same moment, if I could, I know a lot of people know of and respect strongly your playing of the bass clarinet, but may not recognize that you play the other members of the family as well.
Well, it's Peas and Rice is what we just heard. It's taken from the Home album, which is on Steeplechase. It was recorded with a quartet I was playing. Recorded that actually on alto saxophone. Yeah. You know, Ben, it's... playing instruments is... the mechanics of the instrument are a problem. Maybe a problem. But the ability or the... the ability to ingest, to accept, to understand what an instrument sounds like. If you have that, then you can play the instrument because you know what it sounds like. You know the sound. While you may hear me playing the bass clarinet, the alto clarinet is the same clarinet, it's just smaller. And the B-flat clarinet is the same clarinet, but it's just smaller. So it's a matter of, the fingering is the same. There are some little nuances that are in there, but one has to be flexible. And over the years, I've found that that I fall into that realm of flexibility because it's I don't lock into because it's, ultimately the music comes from here, from the person, and it's not the instrument that's the issue. But unfortunately, many think that. It's the instrument. You know, you can talk qualitatively about if I have a million-dollar instrument, well, that's, you know, I should sound pretty good. You know, I should sound pretty good. I should sound pretty
good. Right.
But how many of us have, you know, million-dollar instruments? And so it's a matter of what you, like, you know, you hear this all your life. You get out of life what you put in it. You get out of the instrument what you put in it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing.
So do you think it's a fair statement that some of the solos that you would take on oboe or bassoon, for instance, would be more or less similar in conception?
Oh, most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. It's just that I've got... It's another voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. It's another voice. Nothing changes. I mean, I'm the person that I am. It's just that this instrument yields. It gives up this kind of sound. So you hear that sound and you say, oh, yeah. But if you were to, I guess, discard the sound and go with the markings in scientific mode, if you will, you'd find that the beats or the rhythms are all the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's me.
Is that equally true for the way that you work as a composer? In other words, you mentioned having played Peas and Rice on a recording earlier on alto saxophone, and here... crossing a boundary that I guess you're saying and might rightly be perceived as a not a boundary or a small one, but when you write a piece, does it fall in your mind within a certain sound spectrum such that this is a piece for flute and I'll probably never play it on oboe, or this is a piece for saxophone?
I just write.
Mm-hmm.
And then after maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe years, I'll come back and look at the piece and say, oh, I think I'll play that on this instrument. Oh, I think I'll play it. Because I just write. I rarely write with an instrument in mind. No. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that way.
Well, with the different sort of instruments in mind, I suppose in modern times, in 1996, hearing this music wouldn't bring up the question quite as quickly as listening to it, for instance, in 1976 or 1966. But particularly with compositions such as some of the ones that we've heard here and many of the pieces that you've written for your own performances throughout the years that seem to reflect a heavy calypso feel or a very strong rhythmic sense, even in the compositions, let alone in the performance or soloing over those compositions... People will come up to you on the street after hearing this program and say, but how did you do that with no bass and drums?
you know, I've been teaching for, I've taught for, a number of years in public institutions. I started in 1961 in East Harlem, and I just retired this past May from college teaching. It's our responsibility to play rhythm, melody, harmony, and if possible, while you're playing that, you're thinking about some counterpoint in your head, which is going to make it much add a little spice to the salad. See, that's our responsibility. Unfortunately, you find there are musicians who, because we grow up in a melodic society. What I mean by that is European music is essentially melodic. And I grew up in this country. I went to public school. I mean, I went through all kinds of schools here, so in your conservatory and all that kind. So yeah. Therefore, melodicism is what's happening. So with that comes, for some people, well, they can lay back and just play a beautiful melody, and that's, you know, they're comfortable with that. But coming from the African-American, I should say African-Caribbean experience, where African music is derived, the drum is key. And out of the drum, you get melody. But many of us Westerners don't perceive that. We think of melody as this mellifluousness that's floating around. Don't understand, because if those of you who are out there and you want to try something, you can just go to a kitchen table or a table and tap on it. But listen closely, and you'll find that there are different pitches when you tap. And when you tap in different parts of the table, you'll hear different pitches. But unfortunately, that's an alien way to approach it. So in my music, I'm thinking rhythmically, I'm thinking harmonically, and I'm thinking melodically. And so it's an inclusive rather than an exclusive, saying, well, I'm a melodic player, so therefore I'm going to play the melody. And the drummer is going to go, and he's bang bang. He's going to be laying out his bass, boom, ding, 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 boom. And so they're going to be burning. The piano player is going to be talking about yeah, chang, chang, and the guitar player, shroom, shroom, and all this stuff. And so then I just go,
because according to the world, it's a melodic instrument.
Yes, yes, right. Yes, yes. So I'm playing melody. That's all I'm supposed to do. That's my job.
Right. So in short, it's a project, and the whole endeavor of making music would be for a complete musician, and not for, I guess it's a little bit easier in these days to have a drum machine going and say, okay, this will take care of rhythm for us.
Of course, of course. Not only a drum machine, hey, people have used, I'm going to say this crassly, use drummers that way. You know, they want the drummer to sit up there and give them life, birth me. Uh-huh. You know,
or keep me in line.
Keep me in line. What contribution are they making? What dialogue? What are they setting up? The drum is a melodic instrument, and melodies has tremendous melodies. You know, if played with you know, thinking about that. So the notion of an instrument being a melodic instrument, the piano is a melodic instrument, the guitar is a melodic instrument, the bass is a melodic instrument, but at the same time, it's a both-and situation. They are rhythm at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in the drums, you can get chords that are incredible. You can get stacks of sounds that are, So to say that, to relegate, well, I'm playing a saxophone or I'm playing a flute, so that's a melodic instrument, so therefore that's all I have to do. Well, some people get away with it, you know, just fine.
We're speaking here with Makonda McIntyre about playing of instruments in general, and more to the point, playing of music in specific. And the cause of this engagement is a special group of recordings that have just been made and are being broadcast on the air for the first time right now. For Makonda alone, if you will, on a group of flutes, a group of clarinets, the same for double reeds, and ultimately saxophones, that we'll be hearing in our program of Jazz Alternatives for this Wednesday evening. My name is Ben Young. The program goes on until 9 o'clock, and the music will go on until then also, and I'm pleased to say that the gentleman who's just been narrating about the music is the composer and the performer himself. One more question, Makonda, before we listen to some more sounds from the clarinet series of these four in the multi-track recordings that you just made. And that would be about when you write the piece. Well, let me step back for a minute and say that most people who have heard, even those who are Makonda completists, who have every Ken McIntyre record that there is, one way or another, of your pieces, and they are almost uniquely your own compositions, will go back to them and say, even based on what you've just said, yeah, that's true, but most of the time it's piano, bass, and drums combination with, and sure enough, it's the reed player, the wind component, mm-hmm. thrust into this role that jazz supposedly has made for the wind instrument, that, yes, this person plays the melody, signals where the corners will be turned and so on like this. And I wonder if you said you've been writing this music for some time, and obviously the melodies are well known to many of us, but when you write the pieces, is it in your concept before it turns into music, or before the writing of music is limited, or maybe I should say channeled into the performance of it, would you prefer to play it, to play all of your pieces like this with 3- and 4-part harmony running throughout the melody and throughout the entire piece?
No, no. I have many, many things that I'd like to do. It's just that I'm doing this at this particular time. Next time I may do something with bass, drums, and piano, which I play. And then ultimately maybe I'll do something with an orchestra.
Mm-hmm. What about the orchestra record that you made many, many years ago that some might think is sort of strangely titled Way, Way Out?
Oh, I will talk about that later. Why don't you just play something and we'll get back to that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. We'll listen to two more pieces then from the multi-track clarinet series. If I'm understanding the titles correctly, they are Mambuga,
yep,
and Eileen.
Right.
For four clarinets, that is bass, alto, and 2 B-flat clarinets. Coming up right now, this is Makonda Ken McIntyre on this Jazz Alternatives program on WKCR-FM, New York. The composer is named Makonda, and his piece is called Home, in a way that many of you, even who know that piece on record, and the record that has the same name, may never have heard it before. Home for a double reed ensemble whose members are all played by the composer Makonda, Ken McIntyre, if you prefer that name, although Makonda has superseded it for those of you who follow his work. Before we get back into speaking about the music, first a word that it's 28 minutes after 7. You're listening to WKCR-FM New York. This is 89.9. Jazz Alternatives for this Wednesday turns into the Musicians Program with a spotlight on a special guest who has come to the studio tonight, like many other nights in a long association with WKCR. Makonda is here playing some music that is not retrospective except by a matter of months. The latest sound of Makonda, Ken McIntyre's wind playing, captured in a multi-track setting that has at least 4 layers in all of the pieces that we've heard so far. And in that last set, we began with 4 clarinets. They were the bass, alto, and 2 B-flat clarinets, all played by the composer on Mambuga and Eileen, and then Home for a double reed ensemble. That I'll ask you, Makonda, again to elucidate exactly what the members of the double reed group are.
Bassoon, English horn, and 2 oboes. The piece Home, it's really it's kind of hilarious when I listen to it, because the piece Home is one thing, and then the ensemble, this is what I was talking about, the ensemble, it moves, it may move centuries away from where it starts, or it may be the same time frame but on different continents. uh,
But at any rate, there's a great distance, you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite true. And again, it's I put it together with in mind that people who could improvise could really get into it, and those who don't improvise, if I were to appear at a college, university, or a conservatory, whatever, I could play the improvised parts, and the others could play the written parts. They could play all the written parts while I'm soloing, and also they can play the ensemble part, which would be very clear to them again because it's written. It's mm-hmm. it's right there. Yeah, earlier you'd asked me about Way Way Out. I think there were 13 strings, a bass player, and a drummer. And I conducted, I orchestrated, and I was a soloist. It was quite an undertaking. I was excited about it. And it went very well. And I must say, we did all of that within a six-hour period. And just two nights ago, someone was asking me, what happened to that string album? You know, it's such a classic. I said, yeah? He said, yeah, you know, that shit, it's really one of those. And I said, okay. So now you're asking me about it. The cover, I see you have it here. That picture was taken when I came off the bandstand at Newport Jazz Festival in 1963. Mm-hmm. That picture was taken. I did not know that this was going to be the cover. I walked in, and the VP at United Artists at the time was Art Talmadge, and he had this cover, and he had this, and that title, Way, Way Out. And I just looked at him, and immediately in my head I said, oh, he thinks this is Way, Way Out. Mm-hmm. It's not Way, it's a misnomer. If I had my druthers, I would have called it Chitlins and Caviar. Mm-hmm. That's one of the tunes there. But it came out as Way, Way Out, and I think that my feeling is that it's, like I said, it's a misnomer, that no way in my wildest dreams would I consider this Way, Way Out,
right.
You know.
Right.
But I didn't have any control. I didn't have any control with respect to this picture. The liner notes, yes, I did those. But the music, yes. There's some interesting things that developed while we were recording it. The album's out, and we're in a different place now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the world gets lucky by the fact that certain record companies were willing to embrace younger artists at that point, and perhaps even, I mean, it's strange that people were chasing music that was known as Way, Way Out instead of chasing it away, but it also turned into a marketing thing where suddenly Way, Way Out was cool, and it was...
Yeah, but this was not Way...
Right.
This was, and at that time, United Artists had signed on people like Duke Ellington, John Coltrane, Charles Mingus, I think Jerome Richardson,
Randy Weston, I think, at one point.
I don't know, maybe, but several, many musicians. So, you know, this is all a learning experience, life and learning. I'm a student. I'm an avid student, so I'm learning all the time. So I had a two-year contract. It came up to the end, and I walked in, and I said to Art, I said, what's happening with the contract? He said, well, I'll tell you. I don't think we're going to sign or pick it up. I said, well, what's wrong? What's going on? I said, you know, they had Ferenti and Teicha. They had film. They had, United Artists. I'm saying, well, what's the deal? So he said, well, he says, Ken, I'll tell you what. The largest stockholder wanted us to put out some of this music. And so we did. And I said, oh. So to appease the largest stockholder, they do this. a write-off, a loss. They can take it as a loss.
Mm-hmm.
Income tax-wise, they're cool. And that's what that was. So, many years after, I say to myself, well, let me write these people and see if I can, you know, maybe I can buy the tape. You know, I wrote them. The letter never came back, you know, not even, you know, address the unknown, you know, no forwarding address, nothing.
Mm.
Never heard from them. But recently, about 3 years ago, Michael Coscuno mentioned to me that I had some unreleased stuff in the can. And about 2 years ago, or maybe as recent as a year and a half ago, he sent me a cassette of some stuff that I had made before Year of the Iron Sheep and before this. And I listened to it, and he was saying that I should, you know, what would I like to, you know, have put out? And it was very interesting listening to that tape.
Hmm.
So I think that Michael Coscuno is in the circle where this material is floating around somewhere or on a shelf, you know.
Right. Well, hopefully that Blue Note, which now controls, you know, quote unquote controls the United Artists catalog, will get a little bit hipper about, well, I shouldn't say that, would take the notion to shed some light on some things such as this, or make it available for someone to hear.
Yeah, it would be, you know, it would be kind of nice.
Just out of curiosity, was the unreleased material, was that from the same groups and recording sessions as
no,
the records?
No, that was Daoud Abdul-Rahman Hajnow. He's in Texas. He's in Houston, Texas. He was the trombonist.
Mm-hmm.
The drummer was Warren Smith. Warren Smith's still here in New York. The pianist was Ed Stout. Ed Stout is still in Brooklyn. And the bass player was Ahmed Abdul Malik.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the group. But it was not released.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe.
Well, zooming forward in history and under completely different circumstances and hopefully with a more positive outcome, we come to 1996, where you're now hearing music that is orchestral in nature, or at least is realized by many instruments playing it, in, again, compositions uniquely. And that's the one thing you left out, Makonda, was you said you were the soloist, the arranger, and the orchestrator for this record, and it also is top to bottom, it's your own compositions.
Mm-hmm,
The United Artists record from the early 60s. The same is true for the group of recordings we're hearing now, the only difference being that the ensemble being orchestrated is replete with wind instruments here, all played by the composer, and not string instruments, as was the case with the Way, Way Out. And again, there is not a bassist or a drummer.
I would like to just, for the listeners who may have tuned in recently, I'd like them to know that this is an experiment on my part, and it's a process. I started with the flutes, and it was really a shocker, and I said, well, let me go to the clarinets. I went to the clarinets and then double reeds and saxophones. And the way you're hearing, this is the way that I recorded it, each piece in that order. That's how we did it. And it's something that I would like to think that at some point the music will arrive in a quartet setting. Certainly we have the World Saxophone Quartet, and we have a clarinet quartet or a trio. There have been a few of those. But I don't know a double reed quartet, nor do I know of a flute quartet. But there's a lot that can be done if we're dealing with music from a what I would say artistic standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint, from a positive standpoint. because I have to say what I'm saying, because I'm here because I experienced listening to music that represented that. And although it was represented by a man who was a genius, and in the process of developing his genius, he was self-destructive, because if you can understand when you're doing something that hasn't been done before, and you're in the forefront, you may be a personality that's even shocked to be there, and you have to survive in some kind of way. So you do what you can, which, unfortunately, is the self-destructive. The art was there, the beauty, the spirit, everything was there. But in order to keep that there, there was a self-destructive aspect that had to counter that. And he died at a young age. Of course, I'm speaking of Charlie Parker. He saved my life, because had I not heard his music, I wouldn't be here. So it's in that light that I present music. I think about music in that way. And I've taught a number of years, and many students have suffered my wrath because I'm very intense, perhaps brutally frank in my teaching, because I think that there's a tremendous amount of salutary greetings of, well, that's okay, you're doing well, and so on and so forth. And no one says, well, that it is not what's happening. That is not it. And I say that more often than anything else. But at the same time, when I make my criticisms, I always have a solution to say, well, look, try this, try that, but don't do what you're doing. You know, so the music is presented in that context, and hopefully there are listeners out there, or they're takers, so to speak.
Well, it's a valuable lesson for everyone who does anything, really. Music may be more tangible in certain circumstances, but it seems like there's always a certain amount of cutting direct to the point and eliminating small talk that can be useful to whatever one is undertaking. And music education might be the best place for that, or an ideal application for it, because you only get so long to be incubated in a school before you're actually doing the music sink or swim in that fashion.
That's true. And along with that, it's like, unlike a person who is majoring and becoming well, I won't even go into other disciplines, but music is demonstrative. And if you come out in the street, or you go out and say, I can play, you can talk and talk and talk, and ultimately someone will say, well, what do you play? And you tell them, and then somewhere along the line, hey, let me hear you play. And when we sit down to play, if it's a piano, we pick up the instrument to play, the person who's listening will ascertain whether or not you can play. Rap, notwithstanding, they're going to be the one to determine whether or not you're doing it. You can say, well, look, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing the other, and so on. But are you doing it? And the audience is... Now, here's the rub. When the audience is fed one piece of the puzzle as the whole puzzle, then we have a problem. Because the audience may sit there and not like that piece of the puzzle, but may feel that because they're in this space and money is spent to bring these people into this space, and there are people who are writing about the music that's coming out of here or coming into the space, that this is really genuine. Mm-hmm. Although they may not vibrate to it, they become intimidated. So then they begin to distrust their own ability to deal with music. And it's they wait for their next door neighbor, or they wait for the critics to see what the critics say, or what supports the popular rap. So then they lose their own self, their own consciousness, mm-hmm. and which, in my view, a lot of lost consciousness exists at the moment, and it's not good.
Hmm. And you're speaking mainly about a sort of abridgment between people actually encountering the music for themselves on their own and making a personal assessment of it, or
exactly
taking it in on a personal level.
They're afraid to. There's tremendous fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you might guess the wrong way.
Yeah. You might say, "Hey," and nobody wants to be out of step.
Mm.
You know, I tell a story of as students, you know, in the learning process, how students come to school and they're into their thing, and they look at you, and I remember this in elementary school. Students looked at me and said in their attitude, "I dare you to teach me." This is in elementary school. "I dare you to even attempt." And I smiled because I'm from the streets, so that was fun. But it persists in junior high school. Believe it or not, in college, it exists. And so students come in, and you have to say, you have to work and get and get them to come on in to realize that there is a lot to learn, but they come in with an attitude that they think they know something. So there's no room for what you may want to teach. And they may be very hip. They consider themselves very hip. But I always say to them, you know, learning is really something. When you're motivated, you learn like mad. And I use, as an example, smoking. Those of us who smoked, the first time you smoke, you cough. You don't even inhale. Just the sucking in of the smoke, and you say, "Oh, man." But your peers are doing it. Mm. So wait a minute. So what do? We practice. We go home and we buy cigarettes and we practice. And we become proficient. Mm. We can inhale. Some of us, you know, let it come through our nose and our mouth at the same time. Then you have some jokesters who will tell you they make it come out their ears, and there's a little trick to that. But my point is that we work hard at that. We work hard, those of us who drink. We don't come in the world drinking.
Right.
Maybe some do. We practice. And so I try to use that kind of motivation, if you will, you know, like, you know how to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why don't you do it in a constructive way, you know, the challenge.
And there's also the impetus to practice that in other circles isn't really there.
Right.
And it comes back to the same thing you were saying about music, that if your next door neighbor is telling you this is what you should practice, this is the music you should get to know, then that's one foot in the door already.
Right. Individuality is a dangerous kind of thing. We want to fit into the mold. And the truth of the matter is that no one fits. But you adjust. You make adjustments. But we, you know.
Everybody squeezes in there.
Yeah, everybody squeezes in, you know. Now, some people want to get their whole body into it. Some want to get their little finger. You know, that's enough. You know, some maybe say, "Well, look, my fingernail is enough. My little finger—that's all I need to be in there because I'm going to be." And in order to, in the creation, there is a certain kind of boldness and individuality that you have to have. But that doesn't mean that you're beating up on people or you don't like people. It just means that you're committed to what it is you have within you that you're trying to get out. And in order to do that, you can't do it if you're constantly involved with people who have another game plan, who may want to go to the races, something like that. That may be their thing, but you know what you're trying to do. Then it takes commitment for you to do that, and you may be ostracized. People may put you down, but the commitment, if you're committed to it, then you go with it. So it's this is part of my commitment at the moment and what we're listening to.
Right. Well, you know, I'm told that you retired from teaching about a year ago, but mm-hmm. maybe it's more proper to say that you just found a new medium and now you teach on radio.
Yeah, teaching is a wonderful experience because particularly music, well, maybe other things too, but I'll say music, because I really come down hard on my students, and but everything that I ask them to do, I have done. I don't ask them to do anything that I have not done. And because I take that demonstrative attitude that I'm talking about, you've got to be able to demonstrate. So I, from time to time, I'll do that so that they realize that, but more often than not, they know that it's not an issue. But it's because I'm working with them. I'm not sitting back in judgment, et cetera. Because when I'm with students, if I'm working with a pianist, I'm playing bass, or I'm playing drums. If I'm working with a bass player, I'm playing drums. I'm playing piano. If I'm whatever I'm doing, I'm always playing with them. So it's a working together type of thing. So it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Well, I hope it hasn't discontinued entirely.
No, I don't think it ever will, because I'm teaching myself. sitting here going and listening to this, going through this experience, it was a learning experience, learned quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, the experience, if you're just tuning in, is not only hearing some wise words from Ken McIntyre and the approaching the 8 o'clock hour on this Wednesday evening, but an experience of listening to, demonstrating, if you will, some of the music that we're talking about. In hearing a recent project that is all about orchestral realizations of some of Ken McIntyre's, that is, Makonda's pieces, that has taken place in the last few weeks and months, I suppose. First for four flutes, four clarinets, and the second chapter for four double reed instruments, where we're hearing bassoon, two oboes, an English horn, and then eventually a four saxophone combination, all of which are played by the composer, who is Makonda, who is also the narrator on this evening's program. You're listening to Jazz Alternatives on WKCR FM New York 89.9, and in just a few seconds we'll return to listening to some of those sounds. But first we'll retrace, for those of you who were tuned in on our last set. We heard a blues called Bambuga, then Eileen, and then Makonda, your composition, Home.
The blues was, we heard Amy as a blues. Amy? You missed past Mambuga? That wasn't actually blues.
I take it back.
Oh, yeah. No, it wasn't the blues. It was actually a piece that I wrote. I think I wrote it in the 50s. And I called it originally Mambuga Shing, because at that time there was a dance craze of the shingaling. I don't know if you ever heard of that. That's what that was. But then I took off the shing, Mambuga Shing.
Did the music in this piece have a relationship to the music that people were shinglinging to?
No, it has it's a Latin flavor. Mm-hmm. That's what I had in mind. I wrote it with that in mind, but also a combination, the mambo and the shingling.
Right.
That's what it was supposed to be. But I took off the shing. But I may have... in one of my lab bands, I think maybe at Central State University, I may have played that. I had students play it. But I even think maybe at the new school I had students play that. Yeah, they did. Hmm. But like that. But it's...
And then what about Eileen?
Eileen, that's a standard 32-bar piece. And I guess because of Mambuga, I when I got to the bridge of that, I went into a kind of a Latin flavor. On the recording, I don't do that. Eileen is on introducing the vibrations, and it swings straight ahead. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go into that Latin beat. I thought that would be. It's quite challenging to do that on clarinet. Mm-hmm. It's really, I mean, some of the stuff that I attempted, that's piano technique. Which works, mm-hmm. The piano you can, I'm not going to say it's a piece of cake, but it's
easier to
get much. There. It's much easier because piano breathing is not a problem when you're doing this. When you're doing things on woodwind instruments, I thought of when I used to play Bach at the conservatory. No rests.
Right. No breath.
Bar. Yeah. So you have to create it in the spirit of the moment,
Or learn to override it by circular breathing, but even that's...
No, that doesn't work. No, it doesn't work. Hmm. No.
So that's Eileen.
Mm-hmm.
And then we heard Home. Is Home older than the record? I mean, does the composition predate the recording of it that you made?
Yeah. All the music that I record, I've written sometime before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I have a lot of music written. I've got hundreds of pieces that if I had to go and do some playing of some stuff that hadn't been heard, I go in my book and thumb through and see, well, maybe I'll do this. I've got pieces written from the 1950s that I've not played. I've played in public, but not recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe that would allow you another sort of editing process in a way, or letting the piece ferment would let you assess 20 years down the line or maybe 40 years down the line whether it still stands up.
Yeah, that's true. I'm working on something for a flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, French horn, and piano. And I went back and looked at something that I put together many years ago, and I'm expanding it. I said, this is nice, and this is nice. And so I'm drawing from that and expanding it into this setting. So it's it's like a library. I go in my library and I'm always adding to it, and I dip in.
Well, they're great pieces to dip into, and I'm glad that you've come back to them again and again, and even again for the latest compendium of
thanks
works. Maybe we ought to return to listening to some more of the music of the double reed segment.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning with Chasing the Sun, and then, maybe we could, if you are willing and we have a minute, we could put in two versions of Chitlins and Caviar to rechristen a United
Go
Artists
ahead. Be my
symphonic
guest.
Record from
be
many
my
years
guest.
Ago.
Be my guest.
We'll hear Chasing the Sun and then Chitlins and Caviar from the Modern Realizations, that is for two oboes, English horn, and bassoon, played by one of a small number of players of those instruments who is both a master musician and is making music of... original music of this caliber. His name is Makanda, and he's here playing music and speaking about it at the same moment. Then flip back in time about 33 years, let's say, to hear an earlier realization of Chitlins and Caviar, which we've just heard from the composer and the leader of that record might more appropriately be the name of the record on United Artists. And this, I believe, is a blues, as it says on the back of the
record.
Yeah,
it is.
And it's also, maybe another reason for doing this twice is we get to hear what could be seen as an epitome of, or was seen as, as an epitome of the concept of Chitlins and Caviar, where the caviar is the, at least so-called, lofty element of a strings record, and then the saxophone and reed part of it is a little bit closer to the soul, let's say, in the Chitlins element, and may also represent some of Makonda, what you were doing, and I think you referred to it earlier as going someplace else in some of these pieces with one character of the piece that perhaps during the improvised portions turns into another character and then may revert to the original one.
Very, very interesting. What it boils down to is black folks and white folks. that's what Chitlins gave you. That's what I had in mind.
Fair enough.
And black folks eat Chitlins and white folks use caviar. Right?
Use caviar.
Yeah, well, you know, eat it. You know, you, whatever you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it's about.
So there's Chitlins and Caviar twice, and I think we'll come out of that by listening to the first of three of the saxophone quartets, so to speak, a piece called Charlotte. And I guess we'll round up where those pieces come from at the other side of listening to them. It's exactly 8:01. This is WKCR FM New York 89.9. Makonda, I'll ask you to catch up, if you will, on the sources of Chasing the Sun, Chitlins and Caviar, and Charlotte in our CH complex there, the three pieces that we just heard.
Chasing the Sun, that was an album recorded on Steeplechase, and it was a title song. And that was I think it was a trio album. Yeah, with Steeplechase. And what was the other one?
Chitlins and Caviar in the Middle, I guess we know about already.
Well, yeah, we know about that. And the third one was
Charlotte.
Charlotte. That's written for my wife. Shashi was written for my wife, and Charlotte was written for my wife. That's the name that she was given at birth. I gave her the name Shashi. And so I've played this, I've recorded this piece on one of the albums, and so I just appropriately thought I would, you know, play it, put it in here, because it's a beautiful, you know, it has very deep memories, obviously, you know, so.
Sure. Well, and even for those who don't know those memories, but may encounter the piece for the first time, it is a beautiful piece
upon
hearing it for the first time.
Thank you.
Ever
Thank
after. Well, there should be a second time for all this music, and a third time and fourth time after that.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. More.
Perhaps even in the situation that you said you would conceived it for, as played by one of the saxophone quartets or wind quartets that proliferate among us at this point.
Yeah, there are players out there who could do it, but you know, it's always the financial end of how would it work. And then again, it's how much interest, you know, I'm thinking now if grassroots people decide that, you know, that they'd like to hear this, then maybe we can come together and do something, you know, a collective kind of thing. I'm not adverse to that. It's just that the situation as it exists now leaves a lot to be desired from my standpoint. And if we are creative, and with creativity comes a certain kind of boldness, I think, or forwardness, stepping out. If we're willing to step out, then lots can happen. But most of us, we don't want to get talked about. We don't want to get put down. We don't want to. You know, get ostracized. You know, we want everybody to love us, and that's an impossibility, in my view. Maybe sure. I'm the only one who thinks this way. But and then you have to wonder: do I want everybody to love me? You know, given nature's a balance, it's you know. For business people, checks and balances. You know, you gotta have a balance, a balanced diet. You know, so you gotta have some people that don't like you, and some that do. You know, so I don't like whatever.
Sure, yeah. And enough of the latter to keep you alive, and enough of the former to let you know that you're doing the right thing.
That's right.
If you're just tuning in, it's late in the program that is all about the music of Makonda McIntyre, known to many as Ken McIntyre. Our program tonight has centered on these works for four wind instruments playing in overdubbed, all played by the composer of all the pieces that we've heard. If you've not gotten lucky enough to witness Ken McIntyre, Makonda McIntyre, making this music in public in recent years, it's a sad thing that we can't tell you there's a concert right around the corner and we were here to promo it. It's not quite that way, but of course there's another one around the corner, and when it happens you'll hear about it on this radio station. And if you follow the music wherever it goes, you might even find Makonda in the most unusual of places, such as the Studio Museum in Harlem in certain occasions and other circumstances.
Yeah.
But it's a good thing to have the music heard on the air for the first time, and this is the first hearing for much of the music that we've heard, although, as you've been hearing, the pieces have a lot more history to them than these recordings of them. And we're, in a way, saluting Makonda, the composer, as well as the performer, just like the pieces do, by giving you a solo statement on each voice or on each instrument with each pass, and then as well, look at the arranging ideas and the melodies that start and close each of the performances we're hearing. What you were saying, Makonda, about going someplace else in the middle of these tunes is an interesting, maybe a contrast, if I'm reading it correctly, with some of the recordings of the pieces. And I wonder if you like them better with doing it this way. In other words, in almost a sonata form where you have a statement and a time to depart from that near completely in mood, at times in tempo, sometimes in meter, and really in the entire character of their piece, and then return to it again.
Yeah, I intentionally did that because I'm a musician, and what that means is I like all types of music. All types of music. So I just, and that can be a drag because in this world, in this society, I should say, you're pigeonholed. You know, we want you to do this, and that's all we want you to do. And that's problematic for me in many levels because I just don't think that way. I don't operate that way. I can't. If I were in jail, I would still be free in many ways because I would be able to go places mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on I have an album out, Open Horizon, and my horizon is very, very wide, very broad, and that's. That's my problem.
Well, in certain terms, I'm sure that could be a problem, but it's our gain, and I'm sure it's your gain also, because that's what makes gives every new Makonda realization a different character, and that's why it's great to have these.
Thank you.
We've got just about enough time to survey the last two pieces in the entire sequence and make it a complete whole in 3 hours, and maybe I'll ask you to introduce Black Sugar Cane and Puunti, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, Puunti. Yeah, okay. Black Sugar Cane is a piece that, kind of a fun piece. It has, it's a fun piece. Puunti is, Eileen was written for my sister, and Puunti is a name that my mother used to call my sister when she was very young. And so that's... But Black Sugar Cane is—it's a little different piece. You'll hear it. So it's a little different.
Well, thank you. As we're about to close out here, I think the news will show up on the other side of the music. Thank you again for taking the time and bringing yourself and your music to the airwaves, Makonda.
It's my pleasure, Ben. Really, I appreciate having been here, and hope that you and the audience have had a wonderful time. I certainly have.
I have as well. I'm sure everyone who's listening has, and I hope it'll happen again soon.
It's on you.
There we are. And it's on WKCR FM 89.9.